everyone. Thanks for being here today. Namo myoho renge kyo. So it's so wonderful to have you to talk to. Thank you for being here. I've laid out the equipment in here in the studio a little differently, so we'll see how this video goes. Comments below. Continuing with selection of the time, which is a pretty involved Gosho. We just read Hail Shakyamuni Buddha, Hail Shakyamuni Buddha, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. After which, another question is postulated here by Nichiren. The sutra passages you've cited clearly prove your point, but are there any prophecies in the writings of Tendai or Miaolo or Dengyo that would support your argument? Prophecies in the sense that logical conclusions to scholarship. Answer. Your process of questioning is backwards. If I had cited passages from the commentaries of men such as Tendai and others, and you had then asked whether there were passages from the sutras and treatises to support them, that I could understand. But since I've already cited sutra passages that clearly prove the argument, it is hardly necessary to ask if there are similar passages in the commentaries, right? If the root, there's this constant, it's a human thing, but in the history of Buddhism, there's this constant reliance on the person instead of the teaching. And Shakyamuni cautioned against this when he was teaching, right? Use the law as your guide. Don't follow people. Don't even follow words. Use the law. Myoho Renge Kyo. Use your Buddha nature. Use your own Buddha nature to figure your way through this. And so here he is, this questioning. Nietzsche is very aware that this is what people do. Okay, you have all the facts lined up in your scholarship. Yeah, but who says that? Well, the scholarship says that. Why do you need to have some substantiation from Bob, Joe, Betty, or Alice? Find for yourself. If by chance you found that the sutras and the commentaries disagreed, would you then discard the sutras and follow the commentaries? Right? If you found somebody that said, no, gravity doesn't exist. Gravity's a hoax. Would you say, oh, well, gravity's a hoax? Or would you say, no, when I drop stuff, it goes down. Gravity exists. It's been proven through science, through experimentation, through observation for thousands of years. Just because Bob suddenly woke up and said, no, doesn't mean I follow Bob. Seriously, right? I'm hitting this point hard because we live in a time when that goes on constantly. People are on a whim just deciding to believe and put their trust, their life, into something that's just nonsense, right? Why? Question. What you say is perfectly true. Nevertheless, we ordinary people have only a very remote idea of what the sutras mean. Really. While the commentaries are more accessible and easier to understand. Well, if what I say to you is easier to understand, that's wonderful. But if it's not based on the actual sutras and your own investigation and observation of what is true for you, then what good is what I'm saying? What good is my clarity to you? Only if it agrees with the teachings, with the Dharma, with Myoho Renge Kyo, do I have any value in what I'm saying for you, let alone for myself. If there are clear passages of proof in such relatively understandable commentaries, then citing them might help us have greater resolve in your argument. Okay, that's not invalid, but if you're looking for the foundation, it's Myoho Renge Kyo. If my ability or a commentary has more insight for you to grasp the greater, you can't replace one with another, is what I'm saying, is what Nichiren is going to say here, I'm sure. Answer. I can see that you're very sincere and earnest in your questioning, so I'll cite a few passages from the commentaries. Okay. The great teacher Tendai states, quote, in the last 500-year period, the wonderful and difficult to understand way will spread and benefit humankind far into the future, end quote. Okay, that's a quote from a commentary. But that's a quote from Tendai that comes from his study of the Lotus Sutra. So, yes, it has value, but he's just repeating in different words what has already been stated by Shakyamuni. This is Nichiren's point. But okay, you want to hear it a different way. This is my whole mission on this channel, is to offer you this teaching in an easier to access way. There's a danger in that. But if you use these videos and my elucidations as the foundation for further research on your own, then that's A number one. That's what's supposed to happen. Your study is supposed to be inspired by this. Your understanding, your insights will lead you to greater confidence in understanding the Dharma, the teachings, right? I'm not offering Buddhism or Buddhahood on a website or on a subscription, a Buddha purview, pay-per-view, Buddhiness, none of that. You understand this intrinsically. So this is the argument Nichiren is having here. The great teacher Miao Lo, another commentary, says, the beginning of the latter day of the law will not be without inconspicuous benefit. And now we can spend an hour talking about what that sentence means, right? I think you understand inconspicuous benefit is an experiential thing. When something is conspicuous, all can see. But when you experience your Buddhahood, your awakening, people might see that the expression on your face changes, that your attitude is different, but they can't see your Buddhahood. Only you can. That's inconspicuous. Do you see? The great teacher Dengyo declares, the former and middle days are almost over and the latter day is near at hand. Now indeed is the time when the one vehicle of the Lotus Sutra will prove how perfectly it fits with the capacities of all people. How do we know this is true? Because the Peaceful Practices chapter of the Lotus Sutra in the latter age, states, in the latter age hereafter, when the law is about to perish, accept, embrace the Lotus Sutra. And Dengyo further states, speaking of the age, the propagation of the true teaching will begin. In the age when the middle day of the law ends and the latter day opens, regarding the land, it will begin in the land to the east of Tang and to the west of Katsu. As for the people, it will spread among people stained by the five impurities who live in the time of conflict. The sutra says, quote, since hatred and jealousy toward the sutra abound, even when the Thus Come One is in the world, how much more will it be so after his passing? There is good reason for this statement. This is from Dengyo, the man who is credited with bringing Tendai Buddhism to Japan. Shakyamuni Buddha was born in the Kalpa of continuance, in the ninth period of decrease, when the span of human life was diminishing and measured 100 years. The period when the span of human life diminishes from 100 years to 10 years accordingly falls within the period represented by the 50 years of the Buddha's preaching life, the 2,000 years of the former and middle days of the law that follow his passing, and the 10,000 years of the latter day of the law that follows that. So, even though this is writing in the 13th century, 10,000 years is the duration of the latter day of the law. We are still in the early years of the latter day of the law. So the conflagrations, the contest, the wars, the polarization of people, not only amongst countries and cultures, but one to one, is only going to get worse. That's the prediction here. So saddle up. You really have to develop confidence and conviction in your goal of achieving Buddhahood. Because without it, you'll just slip into the six paths, right? You will wander through the sufferings of life, as so many people do, right? During this period, the Lotus Sutra was destined to be propagated and spread widely on two occasions. The first was the last 8 years of the Buddha's life, when he preached the Lotus Sutra, and second is the 500 years at the beginning of the latter day of the law. So we're firmly within that, right? We're in the latter half of that. Tendai, Miaolo, and Dengyo were not born early enough to be present when the Buddha was in the world and preached the Lotus Sutra, nor were they born late enough to be present in the latter day of the law. To their regret, they were born in the interval between these two times, and it is clear from their writings that they looked forward with longing to the beginning of the latter day of the law. Theirs was like the case of the seer Asita, who, when he viewed the newborn prince Siddhartha, the future Shakyamuni Buddha, remarked in sorrow, "I am already over 90, so I will not live to see this prince attain enlightenment. After my death, I will be reborn in the world of formlessness, so I cannot be present during the 50 years when he preaches his teachings, nor can I be reborn in this world during the former, middle, or latter day of the law." Such was his lament. So this is interesting. I will note something in this sentence that you might miss unless it's pointed out, or you may have caught it. This recurring theme of birth and death, rebirth and death, which I've pointed out many times, is that we live moment to moment. And I'm going to do a video after this on the skandhas, the nature of identity, self, identity. The skandhas was a teaching where Shakyamuni broke down what and who, quote unquote, we are, to demonstrate impermanence and the idea of self being some delusional construct that we adhere to that is incredibly flawed and creates a lot of suffering for us. But there's a clue here when he says, I will be reborn in the world of formlessness. So how can you be born into formlessness? Formlessness means no form, means there is no thingness. There's no thing. So how can you be born into that? Wouldn't that be a death into that? An exiting of life? That's because life and death are not a beginning and an end in Buddhism. There's a life, like this bookmark, and it has a birth and a death. They're just two sides of some process. And that process is identical, manifesting every moment from a previous moment and decaying and falling away as it then transfers its energies into the next moment. This is the perception of time. This is how things continue but are always, and this is the critical point, constantly in a state of flux. No matter how constant this bookmark looks, at some point we'll notice it's tattered, its ink is fading, the print fades away, the paper starts to break apart and decay, till one day it's simply dust and the dust joins the dirt and there is no trace of this bookmark ever again. It is existing moment to moment in a constant flux, constant change. Just because it happens slowly doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Ask yourself who you were 10 years ago. See if you can find any part of yourself that is exactly the same as it was 10 years ago. Nope. All right. I'm having a little fun here. Okay. All those who are determined to attain the way should take note of these examples and rejoice. Those concerned about their new next life would do better to be common people in this, the latter day of the law, than be mighty rulers during the 2,000 years of the former and middle days of the law. Why won't people believe this? Rather than be the chief priest of the Tendai school, it is better to be a leper who chants Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. As Emperor Wu of the Liang Dynasty said in his vow, quote, I would rather be Devadatta and sink into the hell of incessant suffering than be the non-Buddhist sage Udraka Ramaputra. You can look that one up and have some fun. Question. Do the scholars Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu say anything about this principle of Namo Myoho Renge Kyo? Okay. You have the book in your hand. You have Myoho Renge Kyo in your hand. It is the Lotus Sutra. Oh, but you have to know what Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu say about it. Okay. Answer. Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu knew about it in their hearts, but they did not expound it in words. The teaching was there. They understood it, but they knew it wasn't the right time. People wouldn't get it. So, question. Why did they not expound it? Answer. There are many reasons. For one, the people of their day did not have the capacity to understand it. Second, it was not the proper time. Third, these men were bodhisattvas taught by the Buddha in his transient status and hence had not been entrusted with the task of expounding it. Remember in the Lotus Sutra, the bodhisattvas of the earth? They arise to take the task of propagation. They come out of nowhere. Well, they come out of the cracks in the earth, right? The future. That's what that analogy means. They will be produced of the earth. Whereas the rest of the bodhisattvas and sages and learned Buddhists hovering in the sky in this ceremony in the Lotus Sutra asked, we'll do it, we'll do it. And Shakyamuni said, no. I'm going to leave it to these bodhisattvas of the earth, because it's a future thing. You guys, you're great devotional people, determined to attain Buddhahood. That's wonderful. I laud you for it, but you're not ready. You're not ready for what the world's going to look like in the latter day. You're not ready to understand it in the way that will be convincing to others who are not Buddhists. You're not ready. You're great members or practicants of Buddhism, but you're not ready to promulgate this ultimate method of attaining Buddhahood immediately. This will fall to the future. It's the very story of the Lotus Sutra. Question. Could you explain the matter in greater detail? Oh my God. Okay. Or as Davey 504 would say, oh my God. Or no, OMG. He never says, oh my God. OMG. Could you explain the matter in greater detail? Answer. The former day of the law began on the 16th day of the second month, the day after the Buddha's passing. He's going to get it down to the hour now. The venerable Mahakashyapa received the transmission of the Buddha's teachings and propagated them for the first 20 years. For the next 20 years, this task fell to the venerable Ananda. For the next 20 years, to Shanavasa. For the next 20 years, to Upagupta. And for the next 20 years, to Dhritaka. So here's a history lesson, right, in the transmission of the teachings. By that time, 100 years had passed. But the only teachings that were spread widely during this period were those of the Hinayana Sutras, the early sermons. Even the titles of the Mahayana Sutra failed to be to receive mention, so that the Lotus Sutra, needless to say, was not propagated at this time. Right? This is in every account of the history of Buddhism, if you want to look it up. The Hinayana teachings were the early teachings propagated broadly, while a council was assembled to record all of the sermons throughout Shakyamuni Buddha's life. And the later sutras came later. They were translated later, and they took more time to disseminate, more time to translate, more time to make sure that those were captured accurately. It's just the process of time. They didn't have email, right? This happened on foot and amongst a small group of people, because people were not educated in writing and reading, right? This is why Buddha taught the way that he did, verbally in sermons, didn't write anything down. So it took a long time to transcribe all those teachings. Makes sense, right? Men such as Mikkhaka, Buddhadana, Buddhamitra, Prashva, and Punyayashas, then inherited the teachings, and during the remainder of the first 500 years after the Buddha's passing, the doctrines of the Mahayana Sutras began little by little to come to light, although no particular effort was made to propagate them. Attention was concentrated on the Hinayana Sutras alone. All this transpired during the period mentioned in the Great Collection Sutra as the first 500 years, which constitute the age of attaining liberation. This was all predicted from Shakyamuni. He knew how long this would take. During the latter part of the former day of the law, 600 to 1,000 years after the Buddha's passing, there appeared such men as Bodhisattva Ashvaghosha, the Venerable Kapimala, Bodhisattva Nagarjuna, Bodhisattva Aryadeva, the Venerable Rahulata, Samaganandi, Samagayashas, Kumarata, Jayata, Vasubandhu, Manohrita, Kalenyayashas, and Aryasima. Nichiren's pretty impressive, isn't he? He's researched this down to the nail, right? These more than 10 teachers started out as adherents of non-Buddhist doctrines. Following that, they made a thorough study of the Hinayana Sutras, and still later, they turned to the Mahayana Sutras and used them to disprove and demolish the doctrines of the Hinayana Sutras. Not because the Hinayana Sutras are wrong, but because they're incomplete. They're just the starting point. They're the early training of Buddhist thought, right? If you want to be an Olympic track star, you don't start by pole vaulting and running a 1 mile race. You have to start by getting into shape, by wearing the right clothing, by training. This is the Hinayana period. We need to get you up to speed so you can begin to understand what we're going to teach you. But although these great men used the Mahayana Sutras to refute the Hinayana, they did not fully clarify the superiority of the Lotus Sutra in comparison to the other Mahayana Sutras, even though they did touch somewhat on this question. They did not make it clear such vitally important doctrines as the 10 wonderful and difficult to understand principles of the theoretical teaching and of the essential teaching, and the fact that persons of the two vehicles can attain enlightenment or Buddhahood, the fact that the Buddha attained enlightenment countless kalpas in the past, the fact that the Lotus Sutra is the foremost in all the sutras preached in the past, present, or future, or the doctrines of the 100 worlds and 1,000 factors and of the 3,000 realms in a single moment. They didn't spread that teaching. Heck, they probably had trouble understanding it themselves. They did no more than point a finger at the moon, as it were, or touch on some parts of the Lotus Sutra. But they said nothing at all about whether or not the process of instruction is revealed from beginning to end, whether or not the original relationship between teacher and disciple is clarified, or which teachings would lead to enlightenment and which would not. Such, then, were the developments of the latter 500-year period of the former day of the law, the time noted in the Great Collection Sutra as the age of meditation. Just learn how to think. Learn how to use your mind. That was the former day of the law. By some time after the 1,000 years of the former day of the law, Buddhist teachings had spread throughout the entire land of India. But in many cases, Hinayana doctrines prevailed over those of the Mahayana, or provisional sutras were permitted to overshadow and efface the sutra of the true teaching. In a number of respects, Buddhism was in a chaotic condition. Gradually, the number of persons attaining enlightenment declined, while countless others, though adhering to Buddhist doctrines, fell into the evil paths. Why? Because of the time. Because people were just too ignorant to be able to elevate their thinking to the capacities required to understand the nature of the life process. Certainly, that the Mahayana spends a tremendous amount of time talking about the function of the mind in our lives, and ultimately in the Lotus Sutra, how to use that, how to attain Buddhahood now. That wasn't even on the table. They just, what? That was magical to them. So best they concentrate on learning how to use their mind, how their mind was inextricable from their existence. That was the most important lesson for 1,000 years. It takes time. 15 years after of the beginning of the middle day of the law, which followed the 1,000 years of the former day, Buddhism spread eastward and was introduced to the land of China. And during the first 500 years or more of the first half of the middle day of the law, the Buddhist doctrines introduced from India were vigorously disputed by the Taoist teachers of China, and neither side could win a clear victory. Though it appeared at times as though the issue had been decided, those who embraced Buddhism were as yet lacking in deep resolve. Therefore, if it had become apparent that the sacred teachings of Buddhism were not a unified doctrine, but were divided into Hinayana and Mahayana, provisional and true, and exoteric and esoteric teachings, then some of the believers might have doubts and turned instead to the non-Buddhist teachings, Taoism, Confucianism. It was perhaps because the Buddhist monks Kashyapa Matanga and Chufalan feared such a result that they made no mention of such divisions as Mahayana and Hinayana, or provisional and true teachings, when they brought Buddhism to China, though they were perfectly aware of them. That's interesting, isn't it? So that division wasn't even discussed at that time. During the five dynasties that followed, the Wei, Qin, Sung, Qi, and Yang, disputes took place within Buddhism over the differences between the Mahayana and Hinayana, obviously amongst the educated class. Provisional and true, and esoteric teachings, and it was impossible to determine which was correct. As a result, from the ruler on down to the common people, there were many who had doubts about the doctrine in its entirety. Buddhism thus became split into 10 different schools, the three schools of the south and the seven schools of the north. In the south, there were schools that divided the Buddhist teachings into three periods, into four periods, and into five periods. While in the north, there were the five-period school, the school that recognized incomplete word and complete word teachings, the four-doctrine school, five-doctrine school, six-doctrine school, the two Mahayana doctrine school, and the one-voice school. So they all took what they could understand of this entirety of scholarship that came from India, and with their own cultural understanding, their own, right, ingrained Chinese thinking, from Taoism to Confucianism, and they made sense of the Buddhist teachings in a way they could understand and propagate it. And so there were these 10 different ways of going about practicing Buddhism. Each of these schools clung fiercely to its own doctrines and clashed with the others like fire encountering water. Right? Yet, in general, they shared a common view. Namely, among the various sutras preached during the Buddha's lifetime, they put the Flower Garland Sutra, Avatamsaka or Kigan Sutra, in the first place, the Nirvana Sutra in second, and the Lotus Sutra in third. They admitted that in comparison to such sutras as the Agama, Wisdom, Vimalakirti, and Brahma Excellent Thought, the Lotus Sutra represents the truth, and that it is a complete and final sutra, and sets forth correct views. But they held that in comparison to the Nirvana Sutra, it represents a doctrine of non-eternity. Well, a sutra that is neither complete nor final, and a sutra that puts forth erroneous views. Where do you think that thought comes from? Because in Chinese cosmology, in Chinese thinking of that day, we were eternal beings. There were cyclical births and thinking, right? Even though they had very advanced concepts of things like Wuji and Taiji and Yin and Yang, right? This described an extant universe. Life was still somewhat a mystical thing in China, and Buddhism grapples that down to the nut. Okay? From the end of the 4th through the beginning of the 5th 500 years following the introduction of Buddhism in the latter Han Dynasty, in the time of Qian and Sui dynasties, there lived a humble priest named Qi, the man who would later be known as the great teacher Tendai Chiche. He refuted the mistaken doctrines of the northern and southern schools and declared that among the teachings of the Buddha's lifetime, the Lotus Sutra ranks first, the Nirvana Sutra second, and the Flower Garland Sutra third. Totally flipped it on its head. This is what occurred in the first 500 years of the middle day of the law, the period corresponding to that described in the Great Collection Sutra as the age of reading, reciting, and listening. During the latter 500 years of the middle day of the law, in the reign of Emperor Taizong, at the beginning of the Tang Dynasty, the Tripitaka master Xuan Zhang journeyed to India, spending 19 years visiting temples and stupas in the 130 states of India. And meeting with numerous Buddhist scholars, he investigated all the profound doctrines contained in the 12 divisions of the scriptures and the 80,000 sacred teachings of Buddhism, and encountered therein the two schools of the Dharma characteristics and the three treatises. Now, a lot of terms are being tossed around here, and I'll remind you that on threefoldlotus.com, I have a study page, core study materials, the link's right on the first page, big green button. You go to that page, and there's a list, I don't know, 30, 40, maybe 50 buttons there, titled with different aspects of Buddhist practice. And near at the top, the 12 divisions is up there, the 80,000 sacred teachings, all of these. I try to capture each one of these. And if there's something you want to see there that should belong there that I've missed, by all means, comments. That's what the comments are for, right? Let me know, and I'll assemble scholarship and put it online so you can all have access to it like your own personal library, right? I try to put them all up as PDFs, too, so they're easy to download, but I have limitations on the site, and it always comes down to money. But anyway, if I can't, if the PDF's too large, I'll usually break it up into HTML pages, and you can download it that way. I know it's not as convenient, but I'm doing what I can. Support the channel, and I'll be able to change everything to PDFs. It costs money to host a site that has that capacity for larger files. That's all I'll say about it. Okay. Of these two, the Mahayana Dharma characteristics doctrine was said to have been taught long ago by Maitreya and Asanga, and in more recent times by the scholar Shilabhadra. Shilabhadra transmitted it to Tsutsang, who brought it to China and taught it to the Emperor Taizong. The heart of the Dharma characteristics doctrine lies in its assertion that Buddhist teachings should accord with the capacity of the listeners. If people have the capacity to understand the doctrine of the one vehicle, then the doctrine of the three vehicles can be no more than an expedient to instruct them, and the doctrine of the one vehicle the only true way of enlightening them. For people such as these, the Lotus Sutra should be taught. On the other hand, if they have the capacity to understand the three vehicles, then the one vehicle can no more be an expedient to instruct them, and the three vehicles the only true way of enlightening them. For people such as these, the profound secrets and Srimala Sutras should be taught. This, say the proponents of the Dharma characteristic schools, is a principle that Tendai Chiche failed to understand. I think you can see the misunderstanding just as I read this. Emperor Taizong was a worthy ruler whose name was known throughout the world, and who was said to have surpassed in virtue the three sovereigns and five emperors of antiquity. He not only reigned over the entire land of China, but also extended his influence to more than 1,800 foreign countries, ranging from Kaohsiung in the west to Koguryo in the east. He was regarded as a ruler who had mastered both Buddhist and non-Buddhist teachings, and since Xuanzang was first in the favor and devotion of this worthy ruler, there was none among the leaders of Tendai school who ventured to risk losing his head by challenging him, and the true teachings of the Lotus Sutra were neglected and forgotten throughout the country. Obviously, the judgment was made that people weren't capable enough to understand the Lotus, so that was too hard to understand. So let's just do this. This is how we'll become enlightened. During the reigns of Cao Tsung's heirs, Emperor Cao Tsung and Cao Tsung's stepmother, Empress Wu, there lived a priest called Fa Tsang. He observed that Tendai school was under attack from the Dharma characteristic schools and took this opportunity to champion the Flower Garland Sutra, which Tendai had relegated to a lower place, declaring that the Flower Garland should rank first, the Lotus Sutra second, and the Nirvana third, among the sutras preached during the Buddha's lifetime. An opportunist politician, right? In the reign of Emperor Sun Tsung, the fourth ruler following Tai Tsung, in the fourth year of the Kai Yuan era, 716, the Tripitaka master Shan Wu Wei came to China from the western land of India. And in the eighth year of the same era, the Tripitaka masters Ching Kang Chi and Puk Hung also came to China from India. These men brought with them the Mahavarachana, Diamond Crown, and Susiddhikara Sutras, and founded the True Word School. This school declares that there are two types of Buddhist teachings, the exoteric teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, which are expounded in the Flower Garland, Lotus, and similar sutras, and the esoteric teachings of Mahavarachana Buddha, which are expounded in the Mahavarachana and similar sutras. The Lotus Sutra holds first place among the exoteric teachings, but although its fundamental principles somewhat resemble those of the esoteric teachings expounded by Mahavarachana Buddha, it contains no description whatsoever of the mudras and mantras to be used in religious rituals. It fails to include any reference to the three mysteries of body, mouth, and mind, and hence is to be regarded as a sutra that is neither complete nor final. Now you can see the adherence to old traditions and cultures here, right? Mudras are hand positions, right? And mantras in these discussions are special invocations given to certain people for their karmic expiation. Oh boy. But this is the people's capacity. This is how the teachings progressed, right? Thus, all of these three schools mentioned above, the Dharma characteristics, the Flower Garland, and the True Word, attacked the Tendai school, which was based on the teachings of the Lotus Sutra. He was ahead of its time. Perhaps because none of the members of the Tendai school could measure up to the stature of the great teacher Tendai, though they were aware of the falsity of these other teachings, they did not attempt to speak out against them in public, as Tendai had. As a result, everyone throughout the country, from the ruler and high ministers on down to the common people, was led astray from the true teachings of Buddhism, and no one any longer came to gain the Buddha way. Such were the events of the first 200 or more years of the latter 500-year period of the middle day of the law. 45 minutes. So, he's going to continue. I think it's fascinating. This is a history of the development of Buddhism that few students are exposed to, because this is the history from within Buddhism. Nichiren is a Buddhist scholar. This is not from a university or somebody from the West doing translations and coming up with ideas on the spread of Buddhism. This is from within Buddhist scholarship. So it's fascinating. It's fascinating. It alleviates a lot of doubt. It promotes a lot of understanding as to how we got to where we are today and our unique position in this time to have the capacity to understand the ultimate, the point that Shakyamuni, before he was Shakyamuni Buddha, Siddhartha was in search of this jewel, this idea that anyone could alleviate, liberate themselves from the sufferings of life. That there's a universal way, method to awaken a perceptive reality in us that frees us from our daily sufferings as human beings. How to live this life gloriously, naturally. And this is the Lotus Sutra, right? So it takes a long time to finally get to this point. But this detailed account that Nichiren gives us is well documented. Nichiren is using the documentation of Buddhism that he has studied for years of his life to demonstrate that it's like a puzzle that solves itself. Okay, so we'll continue until we get to Nichiren's day and our day. He will continue with some 400 years after the beginning of the middle day of the law, sacred scriptures of Buddhism were brought to Japan from the kingdom of Pakche. That's Korea. And that will bring us closer to present day. So, until then, please take good care of your health, strengthen your practice. I greatly appreciate your participation in these videos. Use the comment sections. Let's expand our knowledge for our Sangha, which creates more confidence and increases our resolve. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Thank you so much. See you next time.